Good afternoon. I call Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have many bills for today, and I just wanted to note that we do have a quorum present. And with that, I move, I'll begin with the approval of minutes from March 21, 2024. Vice Chair Banner.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to approve the minutes for March 21, 2024.
Vice Chair Banner moves the approval of minutes from March 21, 2024. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes for March 21, 2024. And now approved. With that, we will begin with House File 4548. Representative Frederick, welcome to the committee. I'll move that House File 4548 be laid over. With that, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 4548 does two different things. This committee should be familiar with recovery community organizations, and one thing that we want to do is make sure that people who are on their recovery journey are successful. And having a peer recovery specialist to be able to walk side by side with them on that journey can be one of the most, if not the most impactful thing that they have in that success in their recovery. And a peer recovery specialist should be focused on the needs of the person that they are supporting. Unfortunately, if we have a space where, and what my bill looks to do is ban independent contractors from being peer specialists. And the reason for that, and what we've seen in the state, is that when they're independent contractors, they're incentivized to bill for the sake of billing instead of about a person's treatment. And we've seen that because it looks like, and how that shows up, I should say, is that a company in the state says, hey, we're going to run a competition this month for who can bill the most hours. And if a peer specialist is about someone's success, then it shouldn't be just about billing for the sake of billing. So we're banning 1090, we're independent contractors in the peer recovery space. The second thing that this bill looks to do is to make it clear if there are concerns in regards to the or concerns about whether or not there's ethical behavior going on or someone's not receiving the services that they are supposed to, that they have a clear piece to, or a clear place to go to, and that is the Ombuds office. Mr. Chair, I believe that there is an amendment, and just so the committee knows too, that the amendment is in a collaboration of the work between recovery community organizations and the Ombuds office to try to figure out what the best language should be.
I know you mentioned A1 amendment. I know it's not in the packet. Hopefully we it was posted, the A1 amendment. The bill is being laid over, so nothing moving out of the committee will have the bill in our possession. You should be able to see it online, and we'll get the copies to you. In the meantime, can you please provide just an overview of what the A1 amendment does?
Sure. I looked for a copy of it in front of me. What I would say is we have the Ombuds office here to testify and some of the RCOs as well to testify who worked collaboratively on the amendment. And I would say that we have the experts here and we can turn it over to them.
We'll wait for the copy of the amendment. I know it's online posted. It should be available to everyone online. Just wanted to, if you're okay, do you want me to bring the testifiers now?
Yes, please.
All right, we'll go ahead and start with the testifiers. Lisa Harrison Hadler, please come to the testify table. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Harrison Hadler. I am the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And I want to just start out by sharing our office, the Ombudsman's office, has a statutory mission to promote the highest attainable standards for persons receiving services with regards to mental illness, chemical dependency, developmental disabilities, and children with emotional disturbance. We at the Ombudsman's Office fully support the laudable intent to bring peer recovery support services provided by a recovery community organization clearly under the purview of our agency, as they would be if they were delivered by a DHS licensed provider. Though this is a relatively new service, we know that the impact of peer support services on a person's recovery journey cannot be overstated. We have seen that these services can play a critical role in closing the service gap some experience within and beyond the clinical and treatment settings. Over the last few weeks, we at OMHDD have been working very closely with Representative Fredericks and stakeholders in the recovery community organization community toward an amendment to House File 4548 that we believe achieves the goal of expanding the purview of our agency to clearly include recovery community organizations so that we may be a resource to receive and investigate complaints within the scope of what we do for all other services and under and in ways that are workable for our agency. OMHDD is pleased to support House File 4548 as amended in the A1 amendment, ensuring access to the essential oversight, rights protections, and complaint resolution services our agency provides to all recipients of peer recovery support services, regardless of whether they are provided by a recovery community organization or a licensed provider. We're committed to continuing to work collaboratively with the author and stakeholders on efforts involving this important component of the service delivery continuum.
Thank you so much, Ms. Harrison-Hadda. We'll go to the next testifier, Wendy Jones. Please come to the testifier table. Introduce yourself for the record and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. My name is Wendy Jones. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance for Recovery Community Organizations, or MARCO. I'm testifying in support of HF 4548 and the proposed amendment. So MARCO is a new organization that certifies recovery community organizations, or RCOs. The A1 amendment regarding ombudsman information adds clarity regarding the responsibility of RCOs, including those enrolled as peer recovery support services vendors, to operate with fidelity and transparency and to ensure that their participants are aware of consumer advocacy services. We support this amendment. We also support the change in recovery peer qualifications addressed in this bill, which would require that recovery peers not be classified as independent contractors. So just as background, on January 10th, the U.S. Department of Labor issued its final ruling on wage and hour division regulations for determining employer independent contractor classification under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The final rule reiterates that a worker is an independent contractor as opposed to an employee under the Act if the worker is, as a matter of economic reality, in business for themselves. So independent contractors are in business for themselves. Recovery peers were never intended to be in business for themselves. There are many reasons for this, some of which we've submitted in written testimony, but the item I wish to draw the committee's attention to today is that the 2018 Minnesota State Plan Amendment with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which added peer recovery support services to the Medicaid benefit set, specifically states that a licensed professional in private practice is qualified to provide all substance use disorder services with the exception of peer recovery support services. So finally, the Office of the Legislative Auditor came out with a report on March 14th that estimated worker misclassification rates in Minnesota to be 22% and recommended that the legislature direct state agencies to take a more active role in addressing worker misclassification. So by adding this qualification into statute that recovery peers must not be classified as independent contractors, the state is actively addressing the misclassification of recovery peers, a practice that is not aligned with Recovery Support best practices and is in conflict with Minnesota's state plan amendment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Randy Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members, for allowing me to testify today, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for all your work on this topic. My name is Randy Anderson. I'm a person living in long-term recovery, and what that means to me is I haven't used any alcohol or drugs or mood-altering substance since January 9, 2005. I'm also a state-licensed alcohol and drug counselor, a Minnesota Certification Board-approved trainer and supervisor for peer recovery specialists. Overdose death rates continue to remain at unprecedented levels, and we are now losing more than 100,000 Americans each year. Minnesota stands out for its proactive efforts in addressing this crisis, focusing on prevention, treatment, and recovery options. However, like numerous states, we have witnessed the closure of several SUD programs attributed to factors such as COVID-19, inadequate reimbursement rates for SUD services, and severe workforce shortages. Among these challenges, the workforce shortage is particularly alarming, prompting concerted efforts to develop effective solutions. Fortunately, there's a rapidly growing workforce that shows promise in bridging these gaps, the peer recovery workforce. The workforce has witnessed remarkable growth in the last several years due to its proven effectiveness in aiding individuals struggling with substance use to find and maintain recovery. Many individuals enter the peer workforce as a means of giving back and bolstering their own recovery journeys. However, like many professions, this workforce is not immune to challenges. Frequently, both peer professionals and community members approach me with concerns, highlighting the critical need for clear reporting mechanisms. Utilizing an ombudsman for peer recovery services and that workforce would create a centralized point of contact for reporting and investigating concerns, which could greatly alleviate these challenges. Such measures would not only streamline the reporting process, it also enhances accountability and support within the peer recovery workforce, ultimately benefiting those receiving peer recovery services. The provision of this bill, which prevents a peer recovery from being classified as independent contractor, not only serves to protect potentially vulnerable individuals from predatory employers, it ensures Minnesota's compliance with the U.S. updated labor regulations aimed at preventing employee misclassification. Thank you for your time and attention on this very important topic.
Thank you so much. With that, we have the Air One amendment in our hands, so I just wanted to bring that Air One move.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add real quick that in the original bill, it talked about renaming the Office of the Ombudsman to the Behavioral Health, and in the amendment, it takes some of those changes away. But one of the things that I missed in getting in the amendment was some of the conversations that we did have about changing the name of that office to make it also clear that it does cover the SUD services. So I know this is getting laid over, and I just want to be transparent with the committee, too, that my hope is that we can add that language in whatever final bill. But what it would look like is going to take effort by the Ombudsman Office to work with their stakeholders and what they think the best name is going to be. So I don't have a direct recommendation for a name, but I'm hoping that we can say that to encourage to have like a task force of some sort.
Just wanted to move A1 before the committee. So we have the A1 amendment before us. Discussion. Representative Cobb, did you have any clarifying?
A discussion on the amendment, if you're allowing it.
Yeah, there are a couple of individuals on the list, so we will go with Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I did not have a comment on the amendment. I'll wait till further, so we'll take care of the amendment now.
Representative Kumar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it sounds as if this amendment is flawed from what the author stated. So why are we taking up an amendment that is problematic? Why don't we, you know, when he gets an actual final version of the amendment, we can then move that and discuss it.
Representative Combs, this bill is still in our position, so it's not going anywhere. So I think this
I have your word that we will have a hearing, Mr. Chair, on this bill to move that amendment, not have it stuffed into an omnibus and obfuscated from sufficient direct discussion and oversight.
Representative Palmer, I assure you that we will not do that when we get to do omnibus bill. Hopefully we can get everything done. I think from the author's perspective, he wanted to change a name, which I don't want to do any oral amendment and make some other changes as we're sitting here. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is that the amendment's a good amendment. Like, everything that's in the amendment is good. I want everything that's in the amendment included. We could look at it as that maybe there'd be a future amendment. We could separate out the name piece in some other way if it makes it easier to digest, but I wouldn't say it's a bad amendment. I would say it's just we have even more that we can do.
Absolutely. I think the bill stays with us until we make sure that it's in the shape that we can be able to pass it on the floor still in our possession. Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm feverishly trying to go through the amendment, but so can you just take a moment and just let us know what changes the amendment makes to the underlying bill?
Representative Frederick, did you want to go through the amendment, or do you want some phone a friend?
I mean, I can talk about the amendment as well, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Newbrinley. What I would say is that part of the issue that we're trying to address is that if someone is a peer or receiving services and they're like, this doesn't feel right, what do they do? And so the amendment says that a person that's going to be receiving services has to be notified that the Ombuds Office exists and that they can make those complaints. excuse me. Along with name and address information pertaining to that, someone that makes a complaint to the Ombudsman Office can't be retaliated against in any way. And on the last page, it talks about a report that the Ombuds Office will make to the legislature based on some of the complaints that they may receive, so that way any future actions that the legislature should choose to make can be guided by information and data.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Nora, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing the amendment forward. I know that there was discussion in my committee that there were a number of areas that needed to be addressed, and it looks like this amendment is going a long way. I know that you've also been working with Representative Baker. I know that he's done a lot of work in this area, too, and I appreciate, want to call out the great work that you folks have been doing, working with the partners out there to make sure that we're creating a bill here that addresses issues out there that were kind of hanging out there from the past. And so I appreciate the work that you're doing. I know that there's still, that you folks are committed to making sure that there will be more work going forward, and very much support the A1 that you've got here.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, if you have any comments or member discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Mr. Representative Frederick, to bring this bill forward and for the work that a lot of us have put towards getting this thing right. I want to thank the Recovery Community Organization as a whole for your diligence on this. you know, a year ago, people would come to me with concerns about the way practices were being done in some of the RCOs that we've allowed to happen, and they had a lot of frustration. I didn't know where to send them. I have a place to send them now, and more clarity anyway. I know exactly what we can do because we've got some issues out there that we have to get right. I don't see success in state spending in the peer recovery world because we've spent more money. We've got to do it. We're going to tap the brakes on this. We've got to do it and do it to be more impactful and to help people that are in recovery to have the right person there alongside of them to make sure that they're standing up. And if that means we have to do less, that's fine. We have to do it better. And again, Representative Frederick, your bill addresses a lot of these things. With the independent contractor idea, which I support generally, but not here. This is right in this bill. This is where it ought to be. Because in this community, in this workforce area, it is just too challenging to manage these because of the encouragements of just getting billings going without having quality. I think that's what makes the difference here. So, again, I wholeheartedly support this. We will make this even better as it goes forward with some more tweaks. Happy to help you out. And, again, I just want to say thanks to the community for really stepping out and all the members that we want to make this sure this area get better. And it's going to do some good things because we have to help more people in recovery through this kind of bill. So thank you very much.
Any further discussion? Representative Gill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I love the bill. I just have one weird clarifying question that I feel like I have to ask that I can't figure out the answer to is if you're not an independent contractor and you're not an employee, then what are you? Right, so if it says in here that a recovery peer must not be classified as an independent contractor, then are they then an employee? So then the question is that we run into a lot of these like background study issues with people being identified as employees with groups. So do you see that being a barrier to this in any way?
Representative Perry.
thank you, Chair and Representative Keeler. What I would say is, again, the impetus of the language is that we want to make sure that people who are peers are there to support people on their recovery journey and not just billing for the sake of billing, right? And that's why we want to move away from independent contractors. And so the practice by the overwhelming majority of RCOs in the state is to hire peers as employees, yes.
Representative.
No follow-up.
You can answer that question pretty easily if you would like. No, sorry.
I think it's clear in how independent contractor versus what do you call employee classified? Representative Beck, any follow-up?
Well, I kind of do. In fact, Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, you have a very good question there, and I think we actually might want to have somebody come down to clarify that because of the background check. And so if you wouldn't mind, if we've got the time, and I know you're running, would you mind, Representative? I just think that that clarity might be just important because of the background checks on this identifying of a contractor versus an employee. If you could be so quick. Thank you for allowing this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Ms. Jones, please make it brief.
Thank you. Wendy Jones again from Marco. So the issue here is recovery community organizations, which are independent nonprofit organizations. In statute, they have the ability to be vendors of peer recovery support services, which means they can bill for Medicaid. RCOs do not have the same background barriers that licensed treatment providers have, that correctional facilities have. So they are the place that hires people that have background barriers. And so this is just putting another protection in that they are employing those individuals and giving them all the benefits of being an employee and managing them. So I hope that answers the question.
That was extremely helpful. Thank you for taking a minute to help me wrap my mind around that. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I just want to highlight that this has been a bipartisan bill in its development. I think every single meeting that I've had, Representative Baker has shown up to as well. And so it's a good bill, and I just ask for the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. So with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4548 as amended to be laid over. The bill is laid over. The next bill is House File 4073. Representative Hansen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce the bill and proceed with your statement.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to present this. I'm going for a record of making this the shortest bill presentation that you've heard. We made the record in human services policy, so we're going to aim to save as much of your time as possible. This bill would allow worker training and development services to be performed remotely under certain circumstances within CFSS. This is a simple and straightforward bill that really builds upon the policy language that we passed last year during our human services committees. During the pandemic, the qualified professional or a QP supervisory visits, they were allowed to be done virtually through video or audio calls to protect the health and safety of PCA recipients and their loved ones. Last session, this committee passed policy language that allowed the QP to perform their visits remotely at the request of an individual on the PCA program if they have a compromised immune system. This policy change received approval from CMS in November of 2023. This bill would extend that option to the worker training and development services within CFSS. Again, CFSS is the program that will replace the PCA program later this year. The QP is replaced by the worker training and development in the CFSS program. It's important to note that worker training and development is not a hands-on service, and virtual visits would not be permitted without a decision by the CFSS service recipient and/or their responsible party. Virtual visits would require use of both audio and video and would not be allowed for the start of care visits either. This bill allows for a person-centered approach and helps protect our most vulnerable and immune-compromised recipients, helping them stay safe as we navigate current and future contagious conditions. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you so much. Any member discussion? Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there's any feedback yet. I haven't heard anything. If there's anything, any feedback yet on how this played out with PCAs.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. I could certainly call down phone a friend to give you some feedback on how the previous policy worked, if you would like, if that's okay with you, Chair.
Yes. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, Chair Knorr and committee. My name is Vicki Garrett, and I'm a board member for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance, an association that supports PCA agencies. it was just approved in November by CMS, and our alliance and the Minnesota Home Care Association worked together to create the form that the individual, when they request to have their visits done remotely, that it gets sent to their healthcare professional to fill out that form saying, yes, indeed, they meet that criteria, and then we document it. So it's really just in the very early stages. We just created that form probably like in January and sent it out to our members. So it's just getting started, but people very much appreciate having the option. And I know there were individuals with compromised immune systems that were waiting for this to get approval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I appreciate that. And my only other question is, has a fiscal note been requested on this?
I'll ask Mr. Byrne.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, I do have an active fiscal note request on it, but I actually am not anticipating it having a cost. I believe it's in the policy bill at this point already, but there is an active request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume that would be the case, that this isn't really expanding services. It's just allowing them to be delivered in a slightly different way for, frankly, a very small subset of patients. Great. Thank you.
Any further discussions from members? Seeing none, your closing remarks, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. Appreciate you.
All right. So with that, I move that House File 4073 be laid over, so the bill is laid over. The next bill we have is House File 3445. Representative Hicks. While you're coming to the testify table, I'll move that your bill, House File 3445, be laid over. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. House File 3445 is a continuous improvement study to really try to figure out where are the gaps and the concerns around accessing disability services. As many of you in this committee are well aware, this is a very complicated process where parts of the process live within the state requirements and state offices, other parts live within counties. Some pieces are reliant on input from medical professionals or others. Oh, thank you. And we know what's supposed to happen, and then we hear over and over again about what is happening. And those two things don't always seem to line up. The goal of this project is to identify and map out what should be happening, what would be the best option, and then listening to people with lived experience to identify what did happen. And to work with an independent contractor to identify where those two things don't align and what kind of policy solutions would help improve that situation for people accessing services, using the lived experiences of people who have had to navigate this system. So rather than talk on at you, I would open it up to my testifiers to share their experiences navigating this system.
Well done. So the first person is Ms. Nelson. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noir and committee members. I'm Jillian Nelson, the Community Resource and Policy Advocate at the Autism Society of Minnesota, and I'm here today to ask for your support for House File 3445. I am also an autistic adult and a participant in Ramsey County Disability Services. I will tell you, on most days, my work here on the Hill is simpler, more streamlined, and effortless when compared to the process of applying for and navigating disability services. I could spend an entire hearing telling you about the unnecessary appeals, the three-month argument over a request for an accessibility tool that was already an approved waiver goal, or the complicated and time-consuming paperwork process that seems to always result in being told I missed something, even if I do it the exact same way I have done it every single time. Disability Services is the only program in Minnesota that 100% of the participants are people with disabilities. And currently, it is the least accessible program Minnesota offers. Last year, Representative Hicks and I came to you asking for an accessibility task force to look at the challenges of the system. We heard your hesitations and the concerns about the vastness of the work to be done, but we also believe in the necessity of improving the experience that people with disabilities face when working within this system for life-sustaining supports. We knew in our heart of hearts that this work had to be centered on the lived experience of our community and the very massive obstacles faced daily, and not the perceived process that is laid out by administrators. And that is how the Continuous Improvement Project was born. For too long, the disability community has been the one to bear the burden of consequence for lack of accessibility and administrative errors for how the state and county administer disability services. If DHS thinks that Waiver Reimagine and MnChoices 2.0 will solve all the problems and make it more accessible for people, that is a demonstration of why this is necessary. When administrators think of reform, it's about how to make the system work better for them. But what we need is to make this easier for people to navigate the services. The Continuous Improvement Project will tie in the reality of what is happening for people navigating the system compared to what should be happening. When we understand the disconnects are happening, we can repair the problems with more than theory or reimagining, and we can apply real experiences to create real solutions. Thank you for supporting House File 3445.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Melina Bates. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Noor and committee members, my name is Melina Bates. I had a little mishap with a water bottle, but I can still read it, so.
You got it.
I'm here to speak about House File 3445, which would initiate a process for a continuous improvement study for access to disability services. I know that the need for this is not obvious to most people. I am a parent and support person of children with disabilities. I have provided disability supports in professional roles. I am a community mentor and organizer, co-founder of Minnesota Autistic Alliance, and I have my own diagnoses that make me a part of the disabled community. I am well-educated, well-read, and speak multiple languages, and still the state and county forms leave me baffled and sometimes crying in frustration. For years, I did not admit this to anyone because I thought it was my own deficit. But then we had a Zoom town hall about accessibility of disability services with hundreds of people in it, and I learned that my experience was the norm rather than the exception. And I've been learning about accessibility in both formal and informal education, the main point of what I learned is that it's much more than ADA compliance. Basic access needs also include written materials in accessible formats for dyslexic people, using plain language, offering alternative communication methods for autistic people, for example. If there is one place in the community where they should exist, it should be disability services. The current situation where disabled people have to get through an inaccessible process to have some accessibility in their lives is not only absurd, but is causing people to be unable to work and thrive, need ultimately more intensive interventions, and in some cases even lose their lives as a consequence of lack of access to services. I hope that gives you a glimpse of why this initiative is so desperately needed. And thank you for everyone for listening, and thank you for to Representative Hicks for your allyship and for caring. She's heard me say this before, but I will say it every time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Jonathan Murray. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Jonathan Murray. Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. I'm a board member and co-chair of the Anti-Racism and Intersectionality Committee over at the Minnesota Consortium of Disabilities. I'm here both as a person with disabilities who is reliant on waiver services to supplement my disability tax, the capacity lost by my disability, and as an expert in designing for disabled communities. And I'm here to support this bill. In the next couple of minutes of testimony, I'm here so we can be uncomfortable together and talk about how HF 3445 represents the minimum that you can do to start the process of ending the cycle of you approving money for maladaptive supports that don't fit the disabled people of the state because they were not designed by the disabled people of the state. The mindset of othering peers with disabilities instead of as peers paying extra costs of crip time and disability taxes is intrinsic to how the Minnesota Department of Human Services today is structured. In the meeting I led between the Consortium of Disabilities and DSD about CFSS and MN Choices, I met fantastic DHS staff that believe passionately in what they are doing and poured that passion into CFFS and MN Choices 2.0 rollouts. They believe they are doing good work, and they are working hard. Unfortunately, they're building things that don't fit because they aren't working with the disabled people they serve. In many ways, they're literally prevented from doing so by systems and structure that are in place that reinforce the mindsets they have. They know best, and that echo chamber that is DHS helps prevent them from getting curious, getting humble, and going out and listening to the people they are serving and working with them. During that meeting, I learned that the assessment is built around the case managers and the assessors being the end users, not the disabled people, that they are not collecting any feedback from the disabled people about the rollout process, and that having equal access to your records is not intrinsic to the build, like it is in the rest of healthcare. Staff was not aware of experiences of myself and others that basic cultural awareness on disability is not being trained for the assessors at Ramsey County. And that I have had to do that training myself on what it represents to have less capacity and so that they had the awareness to do that assessment for me. This is the story of one project. Think how much could have changed if instead it was a story of how disabled people building with other disabled people amplified by the support of everyone else at DHS, this project could have turned out to be. To share the vision of what is possible, I'd encourage you all to watch Crip Camp tomorrow if you haven't at Disability, and to connect with those at Disability Day at the Capitol to dream how we can catch up here. And please support this bill so that you have a report on what is going wrong. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing your story. Appreciate it. So the next person is Jules Edwards. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Bonjour. Jules Edwards, Nindijnakaz, Jaganashimang, Megazi Nindudam, O Negamasing Nindunjiba. What I just said was an Ojibwe introduction. My name is Jules Edwards. I'm Eagle Clan and I'm from Duluth. I live here in the cities now, and I'm here to support House File 3445. So you'll hear some of the core reasons for this bill from other people, and I want to focus on the desperate need for this within the Indigenous community. I went to school for accounting, and life happened, so now I work as an advocate for Native children and families and disabled people. I was appointed by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council as a board member for the Minnesota Ombudsman for American Indian Families. I am the tribal liaison for Gillette Children's Specialty Care, and I am a co-founder of the Minnesota Autistic Alliance. In Minnesota, Native people have the highest rate of disability of any other race. And this is data that was collected by the state. Yet we have the least representation and the least access to disability services. Within Ojibwe culture, disability simultaneously does not exist, and it's a natural part of life at the same time, because everyone needs help sometimes. Many of us don't know we have disabilities. Most of us don't know what disability services even exist, much less how to access those services. So beginning in childhood, Native children's most often introduction to DHS is child protection, and it's not because Native parents are bad parents. It's because we live in a settler society that actively oppresses us. Minnesota has the highest rate of out-of-home placement of Native children in the country. There are counties in Minnesota in which 50% of Native children are in foster care. Approximately 40% of children in foster care have a disability. When Native parents reach out for help, they are often denied help, and instead their children are taken away. I have personally supported parents whose children have been stolen because they asked for help for their children, but they didn't know the action steps. I once asked Patina Park if she knew any Native children who used a certain disability support, and she said children who need that form of support are more likely to be in foster care than to have that support. Those who do know the DHS pathway to ask for disability services for their children are offered a 65-page form to fill out before they can even speak to a social worker. I come from an oral culture, and these paperwork barriers are just one small instance of white supremacy within disability services. In adulthood, disabled people who do not have the support they need often end up unhoused or unstable in many other ways. When I see encampments being raised in Minnesota, I think of my disabled relatives who had so little and end up with less. And I feel so angry and helpless. Often all they need is waivered services in order to be able to live self-determined lives within the community, to be able to have housing stabilization, to be able to have food that doesn't make them sick, to have a safe place to be where they don't lose their limbs because of diabetes. Because that happens to us. It's happened in my family, and I am at risk as well because I'm diabetic. When I applied for disability services for my family members, I had to negotiate a reasonable modification with the state for the county to follow in order to access services. And it took over a year, and it took countless Google searches because I had to figure out how to ask for accommodations independently, because when I asked the county, they wouldn't tell me. They didn't tell me who to call. They didn't tell me who to email. They wouldn't have spoken to me until I filled out the 65-page paperwork. What happens to the people who can't fill out 65 pages by themselves? They end up in the encampments. That's where my relatives are. So I also have two adult children. One is 20 and one is 18. Both have disabilities. Neither one of them would be capable of filling out those forms. Neither one of them would have services right now if I wasn't there to help them. Both of them would probably be unhoused or sleeping on a friend's couch, except one of them doesn't have that kind of support network. People are dying. Native people especially are dying because we don't have disability services. We don't have access. We don't know about it. We can't have the one-on-one support that we need in order to fill out the forms, to answer the questions. Many of us don't have an address. How do you communicate with the state, with the county, when you don't have an address? You're supposed to get on a bus or whatever else and get to the county building to do the pickup at the county. Who's paying for the bus? We desperately, desperately need this study. We need this information. We need the data. I am tired of being statistically insignificant because that is what I am on all of these studies. And this specifically talks about Indigenous people. When we're talked about so little within disability services. And I'm probably over my 2 minutes, and I don't care. Thank you so much, Miigwech. Please support this file.
Thank you for your testimony. Any member discussions? Representative Kwok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see the phrase continuous improvement in here. Why isn't this an analysis of the issues, the problems, and looking at what works in other states, what works in some counties, what are the options that seem to
work in different situations. That kind of a study, I think, would actually be useful. Continuous improvement in all the different companies, entities, and areas that I've come across it is a different type of analysis. It sounds as if digging down and looking at problems and issues are a are something that this should focus on. And if there are specific issues on reservations, then there should be a look to address that, because there are some, whether it's open or closed, there are some differences in interactions with the counties internally. So we should have a partnership built between the counties, the tribes, and the different entities that are interacting. I like some of the content of groups involved. I'd really love to have parents and family members who have been in the process with helping and seeing what's going on, because their input could very likely bring a broader perspective. Sometimes when you're in the situation, you maybe don't pick up on some of the things going on, but caring family members might have some really good input. I have talked on other bills of why don't we have the technology and utilize it for the voice interaction, so you don't have to do typing, you don't have to generate a page and fax it. The utilization of technology has been out there in different locations, and let's plagiarize as much as we can, because there are tools that are being utilized in other areas that would allow for a conversational interaction to do these forms. And so that it would work for a broader spectrum of people. I know there are a lot of developments for language interaction with these type of applications. So look at the states and what they've done and take the best options and pull them in and then utilize them in possibly some pilot projects. I'm just thinking we could be more effective with a slightly different twist to this, because I'm sure there are some states, some counties, where the individual said, here, let's do this because it will work and help the people. I don't think we do enough cross-pollination because government likes this. This is the way we do it. Mm-hmm. But because we're talking about individuals from different communities, we need to have the idea of here is the menu of options that we can select that will actually help people instead of just frustrate them. So I'm very open to working with the author and maybe improving this. I just think it needs a little bit more built into it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. I'm hearing that Representative Klum will continue to work with the continuous improvement of the bill on the continuous improvement. Maybe that's the correct term. I have
Mr. Chair, Representative offline Kwan. Offline, we can cover that.
All right. Representative Kwan, Representative Zalesnicka.
Thank you, Chair, and And thank you, Representative Hicks. You and I have had conversations on forms within the system of serving people. And I understand what that looks like. That's been my world for 40 years, from being a nursing assistant to a nursing home administrator, and served people of disability my entire career. And I think the thing that is so monumental is the overwhelmingness of all the paper. It's just 65 pages everywhere you turn, whether it's children, disabilities, every scenario, and it goes on and on. So, you know, I think these barriers are real. I know they've existed because I've had years of families in my office, and I've also had many people who had no family. And there is nobody. They had no children, or they have many reasons why that there's nobody to help them. And to fill out these forms, there are people that are hard of hearing. I've had people that are blind. I have people with cognitive impairment. All these lists, it doesn't know a race. It doesn't know a gender. It doesn't know an age. It is a real limitation, and that's why my concern has been, this is a very important need, and this improvement study is something I support. I just am really concerned that we don't have the SSIS system, which I've shared with many times in multiple committees we're all on, to get this doggone thing fixed, because the fact is people are submitting and faxing and driving records, and they get lost, and there's copy and paste, and it's a very archaic system that deals with the application process for medical assistance and helping people with disability. And there's 87 counties, and then the tribal nations, and it just is so archaic. And so I appreciate your initiatives to, you know, do a study and do this. My only question is if it's the right time. You know, we have an infrastructure issue, and we have an access issue, but I 100% support streamlining and making this user-friendly for people, because I have been frustrated with this my entire career. So thank you very much.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I'll respond to those too. I know there's other questions, but I sort of want to reground in that some of you may not know this about me, but I'm actually Greenbelt certified, which is like just a tiny little step on the continuous improvement certification. But part of what true continuous improvement does is it looks at what do we think is supposed to happen, and then it looks at, in this case, the lived experiences of various people throughout the state, family members included, right? What actually happened, and where is their disconnect? Because part of what is so frustrating in the disability services space is, like you said, representatives, both of you, we have 87 counties. And so there's what's supposed to happen, and then there's what is happening. And whether what is happening is better or worse is a judgment call. All this is saying is let's identify what we should be seeing, right? What are the timelines supposed to be? What is the process supposed to be? When can you deviate from it? When is this first or that first? When are they interchangeable, right? What is that supposed to look like? And that's not going to be that hard. That part's pretty standard. A lot of it's already written out in policy and statute and rule, right? Where, in my opinion, this study does something different than what we've ever done before, is it then journey maps with people who tried to navigate that system and says, how did their journey look different? Where was there an additional form that isn't in statute and rule that some of the testifiers talked about that's being used? Where was this supposed to happen, but instead this happened? Where was there supposed to be an opportunity for accessibility and accommodations and class standards to be followed so that people could access the form, and when didn't that happen, right? So we can identify what's supposed to happen, what is happening, and where we as lawmakers can make changes to fix those places that are of concern. We don't even know where those places are. Just in the comments we heard from testifiers, myself, and just the couple of members who have spoken yet today, we have identified a half a dozen different potential places. And before we can really say this process works or this process doesn't work or this thing is working or this thing isn't working, we need to look at what's supposed to happen, what is happening, based on what people are telling us. Because there's a huge disconnect based on our testifiers today between those two things. And until we identify where those different breakdowns are happening, we're going to keep spending a lot of money with a lot of innovative ideas, throwing spaghetti at a wall.
And I do not think that that is the best use of legislative time and efforts. Because if we revamp SISS and MMIS and MAXIS, and we haven't had the input as to where we need to fix the process from the people who are experiencing the process, we're going to have a whole new system. It's going to be really fancy. But if it doesn't fix the problems of what's happening to people as they try to access systems, we're going to have a really fancy system that doesn't work.
Lee Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. I was like, wait, Representative Hicks is agreeing with Representative Zalesnikar, right? Yes. Okay.
About IT, always.
I would just add, you know, Mr. Murray and I had a conversation about this following committee recently, and frankly, Commissioner Harpstead testified before committee last year, and I don't remember what the issue was, but I asked this precise question. You know, what is your interaction with an end user? You know, what input are you getting from an end user? And they told me nothing. They said literally they had not connected with anyone who would be an end user. So really, really important. My question is actually just on the fiscal note. Do we know what is happening? It said it was posted, but then it said it's being revised.
Mr. Byrne.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, that's the extent of my knowledge is it's being revised, and I don't know what the issue is. Probably that's something minor, but I don't know.
I think there was recommended changes, which we will have to bring it when we are, you know, rehearing our bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So meaning there might be an amendment coming that would revise that fiscal note as well?
Representative Hicks, anytime we have, an amendment, it changes the numbers based on what we do.
Yes, I have an amendment. I didn't quite get it done in deadline. I don't know if you've noticed. It's been a busy week. There was a lot of snow. But the goal of it really is to make sure that we are tapping into all of our communities. I do not anticipate it affecting the fiscal in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just remind the committee that there isn't very much money, and I do hope we're being very careful, because anything we do now is adding to the deficit later. So let's be very cautious about how we move forward.
Any further discussion from members? The closing remarks of Representative Hicks.
I just want to thank everybody for being willing to hear this bill. I think a lot of times as legislators, we can very much be in a problem-solving space, and that is a great space to be in. But it's not an effective space if we aren't really clear on all of the problems. And so my goal is, before we dive in and spend a whole lot of money to fix a whole lot of problems, that we really identify where the problems are based on the lived experiences of people who have encountered those problems.
With that, I'll renew your motion that House File 3445 be laid over. So the bill is laid over. The next bill is House File 3419. Representative Hicks, I will move on your behalf. That House File 3419 be laid over. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair. I am back again with more MAEPD bills. As many in this committee know, MAEPD is an amazing program that works to incentivize people with disabilities to work and be able to remain in their services so that they can continue to live their best lives and contribute in ways that make sense for them. Currently, and last session, we did a lot of work in MAEPD, and I'm really, really proud of that work, including getting rid of the asset limit so that people with disabilities who are working can save for a home, save for their futures, and not feel like they are trapped with an arbitrary asset limit. We also worked to change the premiums and try to relieve some pressure on people in this program. Unfortunately, we did not get that across the finish line. The goal of this bill is to give people with disabilities a little bit of breathing room, like we gave parents of kids with TEFRA. So if you cannot pay your premiums, you would have a little bit of breathing room. There is currently an ability for people in MAEPD to get some relief with their premiums if they can demonstrate good cause. However, the process to do that, finding out about the information, knowing how to do it, is very difficult and overwhelming. The good cause language that we're striking from this bill is pretty arbitrary and sort of not super clear for folks or those making good cause decisions. The point of this bill is to not end services while individuals are having a hardship paying their premium. Individuals would still owe their premium, and although I do not love this, I recognize that without removal of premium, there is the responsibility to collect those premiums. This would just ensure that services didn't end during that collection, giving people a little bit of breathing room in the case of an emergency, a health crisis, or other situation. That is all I have. We can move to our testifiers.
All right. Thank you so much. I have good Jillian Nelson. Welcome back, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hello again, Chair Noor and committee members. I'm still Jillian Nelson with the Autism Society, and I'm also still an autistic adult. Those services I spoke about earlier, I receive them through medical assistance for employed people with disabilities. I want to begin by thanking you from the bottom of my heart for your support last year in what was a monumental step towards reforming a program that has become the backbone of the working disability community, and to ask that this support continues with support for House File 3419. Paul Wellstone once said, "It is the belief that extremes and excess of inequality must be reduced so that each person is free to fully develop his or her full potential." The current structure of MAEPD is built on a foundation of excess and extreme inequality, essentially charging a high tax and heavy administrative burden for the unchosen reality of being disabled. A study by the National Disability Institute in 2020 showed that people with disabilities pay over $17,000 a year more than a person without a disability just to exist. In the community, we call this disability tax. This is all the things we pay extra for to live an accessible life, like needing a mattress that will reduce chronic pain, or sensory tools, or closer parking, or countless other things that I pay more for so I can make the world as accessible as possible. For me, one of the biggest contributors of that is my MAEPD premiums. And every month I make choices. Do I pay my premium, or do I pay my car payment on time? Do I pay my premium or buy healthy food? Do I pay my premium or pay my electric bill in full? I shouldn't have to make these choices. No one should have to make these choices. The choice, however, is quite simple. Pay my premiums, because without them, I don't have the support I need to survive. I live in fear of one day having to make a choice where I don't have flexibility. Pay my premiums or pay for a car repair. Pay my premiums or go to my grandmother's funeral. Pay my premiums or fix my furnace. House File 3419 would give us breathing room when the choice has no flexibility. It would mean that the fear of unexpected causing a loss of services and supports would no longer be a part of disability life. It would mean that I can be with my family when my grandmother passes, that I would not need to worry about going without transportation or heat. This change is not going to make MAEPD perfect, but it will offer us some relief and reduce some of the perpetual worry that comes with being disabled. It will be the start of lifting ourselves out of the forced poverty of the disability system. This is a step we can take this session to do better by the people who depend on MAEPD. And as we all learned from Paul Wellstone, we all do better when we all do better. Thank you for your time and support of House File 3419.
Thank you. The next person is Robert Wagner. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Let me see if I can fit underneath here.
It's not a super accessible.
Let's see what we can do. Higher tables. My name is Robert Wagner. I'm a semi-working psychologist, 69-year-old. I've had the good fortune to serve disabled individuals for over four decades. It's interesting hearing the previous testimony. I'm going to go off subject for just a hair. I was working at Ramsey County Human Services in disability services when I was injured 5 years into that. I returned to that job. I believe I was the only person who was served by the system, in the system, who also worked in the system at Ramsey County. Almost 1,000 people at Ramsey County Human Services. I believe I was the only one who had the personal walk who could inform people. That's a big part of the fix, folks. I also just have to say, in the last year, I have a new case manager, and my job was to supervise case managers, right? And I was also the interim manager there. She created more work for me than the previous 18 years of case managers. So, anyhow, I'm off topic, but I just had to. So on December 26, 2004, the day of the tsunami, I had the misfortune of being in the Pacific. A large wave swept me up, threw me on the beach, broke my neck, and damaged my spinal cord. Obviously, it changed my life. It took me 22 months to return home and nearly 4 years to return to work full time. I call my spinal cord a savage gift because it truly is a gift. It's given me more meaning, purpose, and introduced me to so many wonderful people and the kindness of humans. However, the spinal cord has been financially devastating. Okay? So let's talk about MAEPD. In 1935, President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. And in 1965, President Johnson signed Medicare Act so that seniors would live in poverty, right? MAEPD is like Medicare plus social work, Social Security. It provides health care insurance as well as allows us the ability to work, not be impoverished. A side note, I dream of the world where private insurers are responsible for PCA. I was fully covered. I was fully insured. I was working full time. And I had to divest myself of my assets so that I could have PCA coverage after my injury. There's something wrong about that, that the government's paying for something that's a lifelong need, but somehow they're not responsible for that. So that's my dream. So take an imaginary walk with me. Imagine an accident changing your life. To be eligible for your health care, you need to reduce your assets to $3,000. Imagine that for yourself. Then you hear about MAEPD and you return to work. I'm wishing I had something here so I could read and make eye contact. It's not an accessible world, folks. You return to work. Life is better. You have income. And you can build assets. Now you lose your job. Imagine losing your job. You've lost your income, and now you have to worry about losing your health insurance. You can stay in medical assistance, but you'd need to reduce your assets because of the horrendous MA spend down. You only get to keep about $800 a month. So you have to reduce your assets again if you lose MAEPD. And because of the spend down, you keep about $800 a month. And I agree with Jillian. Premiums are too high. I did the numbers before I came. I made an earned income a little over $1,800. I paid over $4,000 in MAEPD premiums. My premiums, including Social Security, is over $6,000 last year. I made less than $2,000. In reading the bill, I think I need to appeal it. I think they're charging me 7.5% on my Social Security and my para pension, which is wrong. Okay. Right? A little bit. ADA passed in 19... Pardon?
Do you need help with that appeal?
Maybe I'm in the right place. ADA passed in 1990. As a nation, we've made great strides in including people with disabilities. It's our civil rights law. In building accommodations, transportation, and on and on. But the one area we've really failed, and I'm a bit of an expert on this, both personally and professionally, is employment. We really lag behind in people with disabilities becoming employed. MAEPD helps Minnesotans with disabilities work and stay out of poverty and be taxpayers, right? It was a godsend when it was passed. Like most legislation, it can and needs to be improved, and that's why I'm here. I'm asking you to give us more time to become reemployed and stay down our health insurance. That's what I'm asking you to do. You're here because you want to make a difference in people's lives, right? Yeah. As I see it, your task is to use all the gifts given to you so that others can use the gifts given to us. You have the power to make it so. Thank you for hearing me, and thank you for your service.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wagner, and thank you so much for your for sharing your story with us and as we try to improve our system so that it supports people with disabilities. So thank you so much.
Accessible tables would be a great start.
That's coming after this session, hopefully. The next person on the list is Mr. Turner. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sorry, I'm legally blind, so sometimes it's hard to find things. Hello, thank you, Chair Noor, and members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. And today I'm here to advocate for House File 3419, which seeks to ensure the continuity of health care services for Minnesotans using the Medical Assistance for Employed People with Disability program, even during times they cannot afford costly premiums. MAEPD is a critical service for Minnesotans with disabilities who are striving to maintain employment and independence while ensuring they have uninterrupted access to health care and disability services that allow them to live and work in the communities of their choice. However, the imposition of costly premiums creates an unnecessary financial burden that undermines the very purpose of this program, which is to allow Minnesotans with disabilities to continue to have their health care and disability services while pursuing their career or entrepreneurial dreams. We must acknowledge that Minnesotans with disabilities already face numerous challenges in the workforce, particularly getting and maintaining employment. Fear of losing services due to not being able to pay premiums means Minnesotans with disabilities don't take the career risk or opportunities that could help them improve their careers. Minnesotans with disabilities can often find themselves foregoing career or financial goals in order to maintain the critical disability services and health care they need to live. House File 3419 will ensure that Minnesotans with disabilities will continue to have access to disability services and health care even during uncertain times. So I urge members of this committee to support House File 3419 and to ensure Minnesotans with disabilities do not lose their health care services just because they can't afford their premiums. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Any other person who wants to testify on this bill in the public? Seeing none, member discussions. Representative Cortez O'Toole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, I'm just trying to understand this a little bit better. So as I look at the language of the bill and the changes that you're hoping to make, I'm seeking to understand the timeline. So you said that the premiums will still be due, even though they're not going to lose their medical assistance. But I don't see any information in the language, and there's a couple different timelines, but nothing specifically saying, like, okay, you know, this can, does it just go on forever that they can accumulate unpaid payments but then have to pay them eventually, or what?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. So this is modeled after exactly how we did this for the last 20 years for families on TEFRA. So children with disabilities, prior to us getting rid of the parental fee, which we did last session, if their parents did not pay their parental fee, their services continued. And so the department would just keep track, and it would be sent over to collections and revenue, and people's taxes would be taken, things would be taken if it got to a certain level. There's a process and a procedure already sort of outlined in that. We didn't outline it in statute for TEFRA. We don't need to outline it in statute for this. And I don't love it. I'll be really honest with you. I don't love it. But until we can actually address the premium issue, we need to give people some breathing room. And this did that for families with TEFRA. I know lots of families that, you know, had TEFRA, and when they just would push it off, and then when taxes would come, or when they would have a bonus at work, or when something would happen that would allow it. But at this point, there's really very little wiggle room for people with disabilities on MAPD. Like you've heard some of our testifiers saying, the way that their premiums are calculated are really astronomical. And while we were running TEFRA and MAPD simultaneously as a state, we would adjust the way we calculated TEFRA premiums, and we've never adjusted MAPD. So the percentages are just really high, and people are really struggling. And so this is an attempt to give people some breathing room.
All right. Representative Cortizo, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation. So that I just wanted to help clarify for anyone else who maybe wasn't familiar with the process for some of the other programs already in existence. And I just wanted to say thank you to all the testifiers today who continue to come down here to this building that is not ADA accessible and tell your stories time after time, and then help us understand what it is like to try to navigate the world as a person with disabilities when so many of us do not have that lived experience. And hopefully, in the very near future, this building will better suit you and all of the people of Minnesota.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if there's anyone from the department here who can talk to us about how this debt is currently collected, like how we deal with this right now.
I can see Ms. Ann coming down. Ann Bubbs is coming down to explain that. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ann Bopps with the Department of Human Services, and thank you for the question, Representative. I will probably have to follow up with more details. I am not entirely sure if this does go to revenue recapture or not. Currently, when a person has a past due premium, they do lose their coverage. And so we do have, you know, people with outstanding balances in our system currently. I will have to follow up with more details on how that process works right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Bobst. I really appreciate that. Do you know, do you have any sense, and maybe you do or maybe you don't, but do you have any sense of how this good cause for non-payment is utilized right now? Is it sort of ignored? Is it used often? Do you have any sense for that?
Ms. Bobst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I don't have exact numbers from my experience in the past, actually having worked in this policy area. You know, we do get a handful of those requests all the time. Those numbers have probably changed over time. During the public health emergency, people did not lose their coverage for not paying their premiums. So those numbers are probably a little skewed, but I can certainly ask our team and follow up.
Lee Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I guess my question, it can be to the bill author or Ms. Bopps, but are there actually any income caps for folks who qualify for MAPD?
No.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lee Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there any limitation in the bill on how long someone can go without paying a premium?
Representative Hicks.
Not at this time.
Lee Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for obvious reasons, those items are concerning to me. I mean, my thing has always been, we should be helping people who need our help. That is absolutely our job as a state, and particularly our job for those of us who serve on this committee, right? We should be helping those who need help. However, it does a disservice to what we do here when we are providing benefits that people really don't need, and they're just making different choices. And again, I speak from experience. I did not make $200,000 a year when we had very, very high medical expenses for my family and my husband particularly. But you know what? We could do it, and therefore we should. It's okay for people to participate in the cost of their health care when they can afford it. I think of, again, I've talked about my brother with a disability. He did not choose this program, but he could have. He would have qualified. He could have chosen this program. And I'll tell you what, he made a lot of money.
And under this, he could get away without paying his premiums. And the fact that we don't even know if this qualifies for revenue recapture, I think that is a huge problem. I think it is reasonable to clean up the language to ensure that somebody who is in a circumstance where they temporarily can't pay their payment is a reasonable thing to consider. If we get information back from Ms. Bops that indicates that actually this is a real problem and that this mechanism is not working, we should consider that. But right now, this feels much more like we just don't like to make people pay. And that's a problem. That's a problem. And frankly, it was a problem last year when we got rid of TEFRA fees. Because again, if a family is making $200,000 a year, it's okay for them to pay an insurance premium, which is what this is. It is an insurance premium. And so to think that we're just going to eliminate it altogether, and again, at a time where we spent $30 billion last year, and we weren't doing this. And right now, anything we spend is going into the bottom line of further deficit. We already know that. And if there is a real reason to modify what is in an existing statute, then we should consider that. But this idea of no income caps, no limits to how long this can go on, we don't know for sure if this is even subject to revenue recapture. This is just the wrong way to go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. I do want to remind folks that many of these people are already forced to pay Medicare, and then they're also many times paying premiums from their employer insurance as well because they have to cover their children or others. And so many people on MAPD, not all, but many people in MAPD are on it solely because our commercial coverage and our Medicare coverage doesn't cover the services they need to stay on the planet, like PCA and other things. And so I understand the concerns, but, you know, we had a lot more kids using TEFRA than we have adults on MAPD, and we didn't bankrupt the state when we let their parents wait to make their payments and took their taxes and did all of those things, because this is the exact same language we used in TEFRA prior to getting rid of the premiums last year. So I understand the concerns. I'm open to, you know, maybe some tweaks, but I do think that we have to acknowledge that we have for 20 years now treated families of kids with disabilities different from employed adults with disabilities, and we need to do something to make that more equitable. So this was my attempt, but I'm open to feedback about other ways to do that as well. So I do really appreciate everyone's time, though.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative New Brindley said a lot of what I was going to say just about the overall cost to this idea, because, again, it could be major. And I, to Representative Hicks, you made comments about we just want to give people some breathing room. Obviously, we can't write laws like that because we need more clarity, we need more black and white, and because of the enormous investments that were made last year with TEFRA and other things that we have done, we just have to make sure that what is that language going to look like. I don't want to see somebody lose their insurance for this kind of a program if they miss one payment after they've been on the program for 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. I think that maybe there could be some kind of wiggle room where if they get into trouble and they do have an unusual expense, that's something we can work with. Right now, DHS doesn't have the tools to be able to do that. They have to follow the rules. So I'm happy to visit with this more, but we don't have the money. And that's clear, and that is going deeper into our deficit in the future if we don't sort of figure out how else to address these things. But like anybody in any kind of insurance, if you miss a payment, you're done. That's a hard stop. And so we just need to make sure that we're all kind of walking in that same journey of finding ways of not losing that insurance, but we also have to not let the state taxpayers always pay the bills. Thank you.
Any further discussions? Representative Hicks, to your closing remarks.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee. I really appreciate everyone taking the opportunity to have this robust discussion today. I hear a lot about taxpayers not having to pay the bills, and I get that. I understand where that thought process comes from, and I don't disagree that people can afford to should. I also believe that most people don't not pay things by choice. In most cases, there's a reason. Most people are doing the best with what they have in front of them every single day. Of course, there's always exceptions to that, but in general, I believe in the power of goodness and in people. And when we're talking about people with disabilities, specifically employed people with disabilities, they are eligible for Medicaid with a spend down. And if they stop working and they stop paying taxes on their working income and they are living solely off of their Social Security and they're using all kinds of services because their income becomes so low, they end up in supported housing where we're paying more. And because their income becomes so low, they end up qualifying for food support and food shelves, we're paying more. Because their income becomes so low, they qualify for energy assistance, we're paying more. Their income gets so low, the list goes on and on. So we're going to pay. If people need services to stay in the community and stay on the planet, we're going to pay. It's just a question of where we pay and how do we empower people when we do that. And I believe firmly that there's a way to do that where it values people with disabilities, values their commitment to contribution, and accepts the goodness in people as the sole premise for how we make decisions. So I'm grateful that everyone was willing to hear this bill today, and I am open to feedback about how to make tweaks to help ensure that people are more comfortable with the language while also providing breathing room for people with disabilities who are trying to work off benefits, who are trying to contribute, and who are trying to use less of those other things and more self-empowerment.
Thank you. With that, Representative Hicks renews her motion that House File 3419 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Members, that was the last bill today, and there will be no committee hearing on Thursday. Just wanted to remind people that no hearing on Thursday. And I just wanted to appreciate everyone who was able to join us despite the weather outside. Please drive safe. We don't have other agenda items. We are adjourned.